everyone, and welcome. My name is Andrew.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are Picture the Scene Podcast. We are a true crime podcast aiming to put you, the listener, at the scene of the crime. Each week, we delve into the murky world of less-known crimes from the UK and Ireland, and occasionally, we venture into renowned cases from around the globe. As with any true crime podcast, listener discretion is always advised, and today's episode is no exception. Although it's not really that bad today.
Not really that bad, but there's still death.
Yes, but there's no graphic descriptions. If you like what you hear, please do follow us on whatever social media platform you prefer. Subscribe to us on your preferred podcast platform of choice. And if you have the capability, give us a rating and review as well. It means the world to us, doesn't it, Rachel?
Absolutely. We love our ratings and reviews.
And we've had some more excellent feedback recently, haven't we? So it's always good.
We have. So thank you so much for taking the time out to let us know what you like about the podcast and what you enjoy about the episodes. Yeah, it encourages us to keep on going.
Yes. If you like us that much that you want to support us, you can do so for less than the price of a cup of tea or coffee on Patreon, with our lowest tier starting at £1 per month. We release bonus content every month. The links to our social medias and Patreon can be found in the show notes or visit patreon.com/scenepod. That's patreon.com/SCENEPOD. We do, where possible, now release our episodes a week early for our Patreon supporters. So you don't have to be Nostradamus to see into the future. You simply need to subscribe to us on Patreon.
It's that easy.
And we've just recently we've had an amazing live episode, haven't we, Rachel?
I was going to say, yeah, this is our first recording post-live, so that's exciting. Ordinarily, we'd have recorded like maybe 2 days later, wouldn't we? But I had a bit of a emergency in the family. Don't worry, everyone's well. But yeah, last week was a bit wild, so we're recording it a bit later. But yeah, it's really nice to be able to say we've done the live, and it went really well. Like, I couldn't have asked for a better, you know, roundup of our listeners and debate. Andrew definitely gave me a run for my money. But yeah, it was really good.
So yeah, and the live video of us arguing and debating and generally just getting into a heated conversation with our listeners as well is on our Patreon. So if you want to know what we spoke about, it was a very famous case and we disagreed completely, didn't we, Rachel? Come and watch us on Patreon.
We did. And am I allowed to say that Andrew had actually asked me to be kind to him ahead of the Patreon recording? Because we obviously didn't want to go like full throttle the way that we usually do, because we can edit some of that stuff out. So I was being really kind and he threw the book at me. Next time it'll be me giving him the warning, guys.
It was not intentional. I just I got into the spirit of the conversation.
Yeah, and it was all taken very well, wasn't it? We had a great time. The listeners had a great time. So yeah.
Yes, indeed. So with that in mind, it sounds like I've created a few emotional scars for you there, Rachel. But how are you doing?
I mean, yeah, I've clearly not let it go, have I? Yeah, but I'm really good, thank you. How are you?
I am sparkling. Thank you very much.
Yay.
Today is my last day and then I have just over a week off work. So it's amazing.
Oh, nice. Lots of jobs to do then.
Yes. And the question I have to ask you though is, are you ready for some true crime?
When am I not ready, Andrew? When am I not ready?
Well, about 10 minutes ago. Let's not get into that, listeners.
Good point.
Let me take my smiley face off. We're talking true crime now. If it's safe for you to do so, I'd like you to relax. Close your eyes and picture the scene. Today I'm taking us back to the 1st of June, 1990. And we're going to Dobbs Weir in Hoddlesden. Hoddlesden is a small town of around 30,000 people. At the time, it's a bit more now, in Hertfordshire. The earliest record of it being a town was, believe it or not, in a doomsday book, although it is suspected has been a lot earlier because the name partly originates in what is now Denmark. So it's thought to be much older than that. These days, it's known as a commuter town, being only 20 miles or so away from London, and it has a sizable Italian community, with that starting in the 1950s with people moving over from southern Italy after World War II. On this day in 1990, the 1st of June, it was getting close to midnight, so unsurprisingly, it's quite dark outside. But it was dry and reasonably warm for that time of night, with the temperature being around 13 degrees Celsius, which is around 55 degrees Fahrenheit. There was no wind, and that suited the younger people in the area, as it was Friday night in the summer, so they were out enjoying themselves, even though it was late, enjoying each other's company, and generally just doing what you're supposed to do when you're young. Have a little bit of fun. Do you remember being young, Rachel?
It's a distant memory, but yes, I do. I have fond memories of my youth.
Do you want to feel old?
Go on, why
not? I'm segueing here. I put this on Facebook yesterday, so you may have seen it. The if Back to the Future was released today, then Marty McFly would be travelling back to 1993.
I've never seen Back to the Future. I'm terribly sorry, but I imagine that is insulting because in Back to the Future, he's probably travelling back to the 60s or something.
Yes.
Am I right?
You are.
Yeah.
Never seen it. I used sorry. To like you. Anyway.
I did get forced to watch a movie about trainers at the weekend.
Really?
Which Lee said was the best movie he'd seen in a long time. Yeah. It's about the creation of the Air Jordan.
Okay.
Nike trainer. Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll leave that there.
2 hours, I'll never get back.
Fair enough. So in Hoddleston, there's a place called Dobbs Weir, which has some unused ground. It has a disused quarry pit that has been flooded, and the River Lee runs alongside it. It was a popular place for youngsters to go to so they can let their hair down, listen to some music and whatnot.
Yeah, have a drink.
Yes.
Off license.
Yes.
Smoke a pack of 10 cigarettes between them.
Yeah, I don't think you can't even buy 10, can you now? But yeah.
Can you not?
I don't think so. I don't know. I stopped smoking
madness
about 9 years ago, but I don't think you can now. So at this time, there was two separate cars in the area, specifically known as the pits locally, each with a group of friends, with both sets of friends knowing each other. The place was big enough, and both sets of friends were hanging out in their respective cars or around their respective cars. They were listening to music and chatting between each other and not really causing any bother, Rachel. One group of friends in one of the cars is not detrimental to the story at all, so I won't mention them, mainly because I couldn't find out actually anything about them, but I won't mention them because they're not important. But the other group of friends is key to this case. The car contained Damien Canty, who owned the car, and was driving along with his two friends, Cheryl Bentley and her boyfriend, Robert Morley. All three of them were 18 years old, and they had pulled up to enjoy a takeaway they had brought locally. Some fish and chips, I believe.
God, Damien was a bit of a third wheel, wasn't he, on that date? Probably the only one that could drive there.
Yeah, well, the other car, they had their friends in it as well. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless it was an orgy, but yeah. All three of them were still students in school, studying their A-levels, but they only had like a month or so left. They were chatting away, eating, listening to music, talking with their friends in the other car, when another car came slowly driving up to the area. They again didn't really give the car much notice because it was big enough and people went there all the time. It was an old Volkswagen Golf. And because it was a popular place, they just carried on talking to each other. But as the car pulled up, it had at least two people in it. Perry Wooster, who was 18 at the time, and Timothy Fallis, who was 19. Perry was a trainee transport manager in his father's haulage business, and I couldn't find out what job Timothy had at the time, if he even had a job at all. Now, Perry and Timothy had been at a local pub, having a few drinks, and enjoying themselves when Perry came up with the idea of going to the pits so they could target practice with a gun he had just brought from his friend David, a .38 revolver. Imagine their displeasure when they saw other people there ruining their plans.
Now, oh, wow.
If it's
a common hangout, you wouldn't necessarily be disturbed by other cars being there, would you? It's still a reasonable time of night, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I don't know, but yeah. At the same time, Damien, he leaned in and he put his headlights on to see who pulled up, to see if he knew them. By now, both of them, Perry and Timothy, had gotten out of the car. When the headlights came on from Damien's car, Perry crouched down in a style you see in the movies when someone is about to shoot. He got the gun out of his pocket, putting his arms in front of him. He made the pose he was aiming to shoot with the gun, which he was doing, but he wasn't really aiming, and he fired two shots purposely above the roofs of the cars to scare them away.
Joking me?
Yeah.
So he'd had a few beers. He's obviously feeling very confident, wasn't he?
Yeah. And it unsurprisingly, Rachel, it had the desired effect. The first car's occupants quickly jumped into the car and they sped off in the opposite direction. And Damien, Cheryl and Robert, they jumped in Damien's car to do the same thing. For them, though, because of the way they was pointing, it meant driving past Perry and Timothy. By the time Damien drove past them, the two men had jumped back in the car. And after the car had passed them, Perry leaned out of the window and took aim, firing his gun once.
So the shots weren't to distract and get rid of the two cars. They were intentional to concern the occupants. And then he obviously got the idea that he enjoyed the thrill of shooting. He wanted to hurt someone.
Right, possibly. I mean, we don't know exactly why he did it, but yeah. Well, actually, we'll get into why he said he did it later.
Wow.
But yeah. Okay. So with the car roughly between 30 and 50 yards away when the gun was fired, it wasn't really that far, Rachel. The bullet travelled through the rear light of Damien's car, through his back seat, and into Cheryl. Damien would say that at this exact moment, he thought Cheryl had fainted as she gave out a loud shout and then slumped forward. But Cheryl hadn't fainted. She had died almost instantly when a bullet hit her. When Damien had cleared the car, cleared the car that Perry and Timothy was in, he realised that Cheryl was seriously injured. Not knowing she was likely already dead, so he rushed to the nearest police station because it wasn't that far away. Now, shortly after that happened, Perry and Timothy stayed in the location, happy that everyone else had left, and they continued to play with the gun. Now, this would imply that they wasn't really aware of what had happened, like the damage they had done. Perry especially, because he had fired a gun, and the damage, it implies that he didn't really know that damage had been caused, that he'd taken a life, because if he had, would you really stay there and just continue to mess about with the gun?
Well, I see where you're coming from. But he went for an intentional third shot, as they're driving away. I believe through that, he intended to cause some harm.
Okay, that's an interesting point of view. I'll let you park that for a moment.
Just let me wrap that up.
Sorry.
For now, he got the two warning shots had the desired effect. One car sped off and the other car was turning to speed off.
Yeah,
he went for a third shot, in my opinion, from what you've told us, because he wanted to satisfy himself that, yeah, he'd caused some sort of damage. But yeah, it's just my opinion.
But you might be right, because at some point, though, Perry must have realized something, because he decided to throw the gun and the rest of the ammo he had left into the lake. Well, it wasn't really a lake. It was a flooded quarry pit, but everyone called it a lake. An hour or two later, the police arrived, assuming the place would be empty, because who stays around when there's been a shooting? But to their surprise, they found both Perry and Timothy still there. They were immediately searched, but nothing was found because the gun and bullets had been thrown into the water. But they were arrested anyway. As Perry had been the one to actually fire the gun, I'm going to focus mainly on him, if that's okay, Rachel.
Yeah, sense.
Once he was taken to the police station, he would end up being interviewed on 6 separate times while being held initially. In his first interview, he simply denied being involved at all in the shooting, claiming he wasn't there when it happened and he knew nothing about it.
I imagine though the victims in the car with the girl, they'd had a good sighting of him. As with the other cars, you know, he'd been easily describable, right?
Yeah.
So that story's not really going to wash with the police.
No, and I think he realised this because in the second interview, before he agreed to answer any more questions, he asked for a solicitor. Now, over the course of the next 5 interviews, he admitted to being there with the gun. He admitted to firing the gun, but with great gusto, in every interview, he stuck by his assertion that at no stage at all had he intended to hurt anyone. Now, in the second interview, he would describe what happened. He said that the car had been driven towards them, so they had to jump in the car to avoid being hit. His exact words were, "It was like they were trying to run us over, so we got into the car and we left." Now, obviously, I don't know why he said that, because he was still there when the police turned up, but yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's just calling out the naivety of an 18-year-old, like, A, not being old enough to manage and handle a gun, like a weapon, because, you know, he's still telling lies that a young child would think they could get away with by not, you know, thinking that anyone could prove him wrong.
Yeah. He did admit to firing a shot at the car as it went past, but he said that he was aiming to miss the car, like with the first 2 shots. Now, he kept repeating over and over that he didn't mean to hit the car. He was aiming to miss. So I know you've said it briefly, but what do you think, Rachel? I think I know what you think, but do you think he was meaning to hit the car? Or do you think he was just repeating what he's been told to say by his solicitor?
Yeah, I think it's circling in his mind that if he defends himself and claims innocence, that he'll get away with it. You know, I didn't mean to hit the car. I just didn't mean to hit the car. Like, it's so easy to say, you know, you spill something over and you get in trouble with your mum or your dad. Oh, I didn't mean to, you know, I didn't do it on purpose. Like, it's an easy line of defense, isn't it? But what I would say is he'd have known that he'd have hit the car, because the sound of a bullet in the air would be very different to the sound of a bullet hitting, for instance, you said, the rear light, traveling through the car. You'd have heard the glass breaking on the rear light.
You would, yes.
So he'd have been, you know, again, very aware that he'd have successfully hit something. And I'm not saying he intended to kill, but I think he fired that third shot with the intention of harm.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, if his solicitor's there now, if his solicitor's there now, then I suspect that his solicitor probably told him, look, you can't try and say that you didn't fire this gun, because it's obvious you did. So if you stick to the fact that you kept saying that you meant to miss, then we're talking manslaughter, not murder.
Yeah.
I imagine that's what he was told, but I could be wrong.
No, it makes sense to me.
He would say that he didn't know why he shot at the car, that he was simply just messing around. But this was just a second interview out of 6, though, Rachel, and his story would slightly change over the course of the interviews. The points that he was never aiming for the car didn't change, along with the facts he said he wasn't trying to injure or hurt anyone. But he did change his story in as much as he admitted shooting towards the car, but he was hoping that he'd miss it. He changed it.
You're playing with fire there, literally. You know, I was hoping I'd miss it. Like, why shoot the third time? You know, there's no sense. If he'd have shot in quick succession, 1, 2, bang, bang, the first time that he loaded and pulled the trigger, you could understand the error of judgment. Okay, I shot the first time and then I misaimed and shot the second and hit the car. But he's had time to think. He's had his moment to scare. That moment's passed. Like, I think he has, in my opinion, made a calculated decision to pull that trigger a third time.
It's interesting, because he changed his story from not knowing why he shot the gun and that he was just messing around to the fact that he was trying to scare them. He was not trying to hit the car, but he was trying to scare them by shooting at them. Now, this is important, what I'm about to say later on. So remember this, everyone listening, and you as well, Rachel. In one important part of the interview, he describes to the detective interviewing him how he fired a gun. He said he was leaning out of the car window and he was firing down into the ground when he said that he indicated with his hands that he was firing down, you know, like with a shooting motion with his hand.
Yeah.
The detective, when he made that hand movement, said, "If you do that, you're firing down." And Perry replied, "Yeah, I was firing down." So, unsurprisingly, Rachel, he was taken to trial. Just like in the last episode, if you remember, with the teacher who killed his wife, Perry offered via his legal team to plead guilty to manslaughter straight away. But that was rejected. He was charged with murder. As well as Perry, his friend Timothy was charged with having a gun and ammo in a public place and also perverting the course of justice. And his friend who helped him buy the gun, Paul Wines, who was 19 at the time, would be charged with aiding and abetting Perry buy a gun without a proper certificate and transferring ammo to him.
Okay, so Timothy was culpable as Perry for owning the gun, for having the property of a gun.
For handling the gun, yeah. He handled
it. Wow.
So, and yeah, so Paul, his friend Paul got charged for helping him buy the gun. And then also a friend he bought the gun from, a 28-year-old David Baggs, was charged with unlawfully dealing in firearms by selling the gun and bullets to Perry without seeing a certificate. And by the way, the gun was an old gun from like one of the previous wars. It wasn't like a modern revolver or anything. Wow. And also David, who sold him the gun, when he was arrested for that charge, his home was searched and an unregistered shotgun and cartridges were found without a qualifying certificate. So he was charged with possession of those also.
Lordy.
Now, all three of them, excluding Perry, so Timothy and his two other friends, they all pled guilty at the first opportunity. So Timothy, so I'm just going to get these out of the way with, because we know they pled guilty. Timothy was given a 9-month sentence in a youth detention facility for having a gun and ammo in a public place and perverting the course of justice. That perverting the course of justice, by the way, was lying to the police because Perry threw the gun and bullets into the water and he said he didn't know anything about a gun. Paul, his friend who helped him buy the gun, was ordered to do 180 hours community service for aiding and abetting Perry to buy the gun. And it's really weird because the thought is aiding and abetting to buy a gun without a proper certificate and transferring ammo to him. So it's quite a long sentence. And finally, David, who sold him the gun, was given a total sentence of 4 years for unlawfully dealing in firearms by selling a gun and bullets to Perry without seeing a certificate. And also,
how much did Timothy get?
9 months.
9 months. Wow. Okay.
And also for the shotgun as well. So that 4 years was in total. Now, interesting, before I get back onto Perry, David appealed that 4-year sentence for being too long. So how the original judge split that up? It was 2 years for selling the gun, 1 year to be served concurrently, the same time as the gun sentence for selling the bullets, and then 2 years to be served consecutively for the shotgun possession. So 4 years in total. Now on appeal, the appeal judge said that while selling the gun and bullets was the correct length, so 2 years in total, because the 1 year would be concurrently, that 1 year would be more appropriate for possession of the shotgun. So his total sentence was actually cut down from 4 years down to 3.
Yeah, I can understand why the shotgun sentence was reduced. And I totally agree that the selling of the firearm shouldn't have been, because essentially he created the chain of events that led to the young girl's death. And he should be punished accordingly to put off anyone else from, you know, selling a firearm in the early 90s to pals, you know, to make money.
Exactly. So let's get back to Perry then. His whole defense was basically that he didn't mean to do it, so it should be manslaughter and not murder. So there was no need to prove that he did it because he didn't deny that. So I'm not going to go into that. And they had the gun anyway, because they recovered the gun and bullets from the water. So I'm not going to go into, did he do it? We know he did.
Well, he tried to deny it at the start.
Yeah.
And I get it. By the time it goes to trial, you just have to deal with the facts that are in front of you. But it's interesting, isn't it? How, you know, that was his first line of defense. I didn't do it. I wasn't there. You know, I wonder whether that was brought up in court, that like you almost can't believe what he has to say because his first line of defense was so unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it wasn't though. At the trial, the prosecution called a firearms expert as a witness. He described that the bullet had entered through the rear of the car in a straight line, through the back seat, and entered Cheryl, killing her. He said that there was no deviation either sideways or up or down between the hole in the back seat and the hole in the back of the car, which indicated that there was a straight line of shots and it was fired from directly behind the car, not off at an angle. So this is a quote from his evidence, just a little quote. The final arbiter must be the actual alignments of the gun barrel at the moment it is discharged. And in this case, the gun barrel was pointed directly at the rear of the vehicle and a shot struck it directly. Now, whether the person in this particular instance meant to hit that exact part of the rear of the vehicle or something else, I do not know. And let's be honest, he's a gun expert, so he wouldn't know what Perry meant to do. He's not a people expert. He's just testifying on the gun.
Yeah, he's giving the facts and the figures. Like, the psychological experts will give the opinion of the human operating the gun, right?
Yeah. Now, interestingly, the defense, well, as always, we know it's always a prosecution and defense. They get their own experts on the case, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So the defense had commissioned a report from their own firearms expert, but it was deemed by the defense that it was too dangerous to submit the report into evidence, along with calling the expert for witness, that it was marked not for disclosure. And it was mainly down to this one line in the report where their own expert is talking about the gun. And it says this: certainly, it was pointing at the rear offside in a line towards the driver, but errors in firing pistols so overwhelmed their possible accuracy that suggestion of a determined and successful shot at a driver must be fought.
Wow.
So the only other, and that was saying simply because of that first bit of that, where it says certainly it was a point at the rear offside in a line towards the driver. So that their own expert said it was a straight line. So they said, we're not going to put that into evidence. So the only other issue was the distance the car was when the gun was fired. The prosecution, backed up by all the eyewitnesses, especially Damien Canty, the driver of the car Cheryl was in, and Timothy, who was Perry's friend who was driving a VW Golf, the car Perry arrived in, they all stated the distance was between 25 and 50 feet. And the defense argued that it was more than likely 100 feet away. So,
quite a distance then, quite a discrepancy between the two. And I'm not sure I'd believe Damien's viewpoint on looking through a rearview mirror and determining how far away he was. I'd be more inclined to go with Timothy's opinion on that. But yeah, Interesting that they both came to the same conclusion of a similar distance away.
Yeah. Now, after a 6-day trial and 8 hours of deliberation, do you think he was guilty or not guilty of murder or manslaughter?
I personally think he's been found guilty of murder. If the prosecution have refused the plea agreement for manslaughter, I think they've fought a good trial to have him done for murder. So, but I was wrong last week, so we'll see.
He was found guilty of murder, with the judge imposing a mandatory life sentence for murder. Now, this may sound odd, everyone, but I couldn't actually find out how long he got as a minimum term, because I had the court transcripts from the trial, but I couldn't find them from the sentencing hearing, and all the newspapers just said life. So I don't know what his minimum term was.
You know what, though? There might have been a change since 1991 when the case was at trial that, you know, back then life might have meant life in prison, mightn't it?
Yeah, no, it did. It might have done, but no, it didn't.
Just
for the next couple of paragraphs, because I talk about when he got out. He was convicted on the 10th of June 1991. Now, his family, and obviously Perry himself, wouldn't accept this, so they hired the quite famous barrister, Michael Mansfield QC, although now he'd be KC, to work on the appeal. Have you heard of him, Michael Mansfield?
Yes, I have actually. The name rings a bell. Yeah. But what I would say as well is, like, how brash of that family to be defending their son when he's taken a life.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I get it, right? Yeah, you'd probably fight for your own child. But he's admitted that he killed that woman. Like, he's not denying that. Yes, fair enough, he said he didn't do it intentionally. But then to dispute the fact that a jury are finding guilty and want him out of jail early when he gets to still live his life and live and breathe every day. I feel that's quite brash. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's his family, so they're going to believe everything that he says. And maybe, like, we're not gotten to the appeal yet. Maybe he was telling the truth, but so you're going to stick by. I see what you're saying. From an outsider looking in, you're right. But when it's your family, you're going to believe him. So yeah, Michael Mansfield himself has been described as a king of human rights work due to the cases he's worked on over his working life. He's in his 80s now, so it doesn't really work, but... And he was probably one, if not the most well-known barrister in the UK. So they really went to town trying to get his appeal here. In 1994, Perry's appeal was heard, and it was heard on two key points. The first being that the judge had misdirected the jury as to what intention it is, and the difference between the consequences in relation to a conviction for murder or a conviction for manslaughter. Now, secondly, on the fact that there was no sufficient evidence on which a jury could have concluded that what occurred that night amounted to murder as opposed to manslaughter. Now, after much deliberation, the appeal court rejected the appeal on both counts. But that didn't stop Perry's family fighting to get the murder conviction changed to manslaughter. And in 1998, it managed to convince the Criminal Cases Review Commission to consider the matter, of which the commission looked at several arguments, and they also did their own investigation, including hiring a new expert to look at the original expert's testimony and findings, along with investigating it himself. Now, this expert, a Dr. Renshaw, concluded that, yes, the original expert's opinion that the gun was fired from between 15 and 40 yards away. I know I'm talking about yards here, but they did talk in yards now. From between 50 and 40 yards away could be correct. And a yard to everyone listening is 3 feet. So the original expert said it was between 45 feet and 120 feet. So that still fits in the 45 feet with what the eyewitnesses said. But the new expert for the commission also found a possibility, due to the angles the bullet entered the car and the area itself, that it could also have been fired from 185 yards away. And that's a big difference. That's like almost 600 feet.
I get it, but yeah, it's also very well known that you can find an expert to corroborate anything you want to say in court, can't you?
Yeah, but this is the independent commission. So
the independent commissioner found the expert, not yeah. the
No, the independent defense. Commission agreed to look at it, and they hired the expert. It wasn't the defense.
Yeah.
So, and the independent expert said that if it was 185 yards away, it meant that in order for the bullet to enter the car in the way that it did, the gun would have had to have been fired upwards so that gravity and air pressure would bring the bullet down enough to enter the car how it did. So with this in mind, they granted that there could be enough evidence to grant a fresh appeal, so they referred it to the Court of Appeal again. So this was in 2000, on the 30th of August, that they referred it to the Court of Appeal. Now, shortly after the fresh appeal was granted, Perry was actually released from his prison sentence on license. So that's why I know it wasn't life.
9 years.
Yeah. Well, 10 years, just over 10 years, yeah. Because there was the...
hang on.
There was remand. He was remanded. It was shot in that... He fired a gun in 1990 and it was remanded a week after he was arrested. The trial was in 1991, so he was on remand for a year.
Oh, okay, got you.
So yeah, he served just over 10 years in prison. So we can deduce a minimum term. It wasn't more than 10 years, but the time it takes to go through the process of being released from a life sentence, it means it was probably less than 10 years. Now, just because he was released on license, it doesn't mean that the appeal was over. Because it would mean a lot to Perry's life going forward if it was murder or manslaughter. Because when it's murder, you're on a lifelong license. So that's the difference, the lifelong license or not. In 2003, the appeal was heard. And Michael Mansfield again headed up the appeal. And the appeal judges actually applauded Michael Mansfield on the detail and good job he did in their summing up. He argued Perry's case on two grounds. Firstly, the new evidence of the expert Dr. Venture put the safety of the original conviction in doubt. And secondly, the summing up of the original judge was so deficient that it also put the safety of the conviction in doubt. So Perry's defense argued that the original expert's testimony was flawed as he didn't mention the second possible distance of the car when the gun was fired. And if it had been the second distance, then Perry was firing up and not intending to harm. Therefore, it was manslaughter and the jury would never have convicted for murder.
I'm not sure about that because he shot a third shot. Like,
yes.
Intentionally above the car or at the car is by the by. He'd got the desired outcome from the first two shots with the cars trying to escape.
He took a third shot,
making a more calculated decision of his actions, in my opinion.
I see what you're saying, but legally speaking, if he fired upwards, it's manslaughter. I know what you're saying. I don't disagree with you, Rachel. I'm just saying legally speaking. And it's interesting you say that because the appeal judges agreed that, yes, while the original expert obviously didn't do it intentionally, the fact that it could have been fired from 185 yards away could throw the safety of the conviction in doubt. They also added, however, though, that three things counted against the argument. Firstly, the original expert that the defense decided not to use, he had mentioned this possibility, but the original defense deemed it not important enough to be put in as evidence or use it as an argument themselves in the original trial. So was it really a possibility if the original defense thought, no, I don't want to use that? The appeal judges stated that while it was a possibility, they had to consider the evidence given by both Perry's friend and the driver of the car, who both said that the car couldn't have been more than 50 feet away. And the third thing is Perry's own interview in the police station. Do you remember that, Rachel? In which he himself stated, with a demonstration, that he was in fact pointing the gun downwards on purpose when he shot. So on that appeal, the ground, they dismissed that segment of the appeal because he actually described himself that he was pointing downwards. So even though it's a possibility, they said that it wasn't likely to have actually happened.
Yeah, so essentially what we're saying is it's sheer dumb luck that it's been proven that gravity took hold and that the gun was being pointed upwards.
No. What we're saying is, so what they basically said was they probably would have had to consider the conviction unsafe if he hadn't, because they stressed his interview, if he hadn't said that he'd been pointing downwards. The other two things they said were a point of concern, but the fact that he actually described with hand movements that he was pointing downwards means that he wasn't pointing upwards. So he wasn't firing upwards. So he can't have been 100 and something yards away, because otherwise the gun would have fired into the ground.
Yeah. And sorry, that's what I meant. It was it was dumb luck. But yes. Yeah.
Sorry, my bad, Rachel. Don't hate. Appreciate. So the second aspect of the appeal judges admitted, gave them a lot more concern. They said that the judge, in summing up the case, dealt with the defense in a very short passage at the end of the summing up. He told the jury that they had got the interviews, which was material, which they were entitled to consider. And indeed, there was a part of the interviews which had been played to the jury, and they were reminded of that. However, he did not seek to provide any detailed assistance to the jury as to what part of the interviews might be considered relevant. He did not sum up the defense arguments, and he did not sum up the facts capable of supporting the defense case. The most that he said was this, and this was at the instigation of the defense counsel. Members of the jury, if I have not made it clear, I was just about to summarize it in this way. The accused is saying, I did not intend to cause serious injury to anybody in that car. I did not intend to kill them. I accept that what I did was wildly, unlawfully, criminally reckless. That is why I pleaded guilty to manslaughter. So the only other aspect of the defense which could properly be said to have been specifically the subject of a direction by the judge was in answer to a question from the jury as follows. Is an intention to hit the car the same thing as trying to hit an occupants in the car? Now, he told the jury that the answer to that was no. They had to be satisfied that the intended bullet should cause serious harm to an occupant in the car. So, I know I've said that a lot, but I've just read a lot at you then, but it's important. Perry's defense argued that obligation on a judge to identify for the jury what the nature of the defense is and to provide such assistance as is appropriate in the circumstances of the case, that the judge has to do this. And they gave several previous cases where this had happened. And he also gave several previous cases where it hadn't happened and the cases had been overturned on appeal. The appeal judges agreed the judge didn't do what he should have done, but they said that raises another question. Would it make the conviction unsafe or not? They said that the simple matter was intent. And could the jury decide by themselves if Perry intended to do it or not? They said that they did not consider that the jury can have been in any doubt or confused about what it was that they had to decide, or the material upon which they could properly decide that question. They also stated that if it was the same team that advised Perry on his first appeal, which it was, Michael Mansfield, who were extremely experienced, and if this really was an issue, why wasn't it brought up in the first appeal? They took the view that the circumstances of the case were such that the jury could not in any way have been under any misapprehension as to the nature of the question it had to answer and the material upon which it could come to the conclusion about that question. So you'll be happy to hear, Rachel, Perry's appeal was rejected. Upon his release, Perry was made straight away a director of his parents' transport haulage firm, and he seemed to be living a quiet, law-abiding life. That was until the 11th of September 2014, when after receiving a tip-off, police raided the haulage firm of W.J. Wooster and Sons in Nasing, the same company Perry was now a director of, and after searching the property, they found a stun gun that was disguised as a mobile phone and some CS gas in a home gym. Remember, he's on license here for life.
Yeah, he's got some sort of obsession, hasn't he, with being armed and protected, or potentially even enjoying having something dangerous in his possession. He's not learned his lesson, essentially, has he?
No, he's not, no. Now, Perry's defense, his new defense, it wasn't Michael Mansfield, argued that while it was in his home, it was an ex-girlfriend's property and he hadn't gotten around to throwing him out.
Of course.
Yeah. Now, unsurprisingly, Rachel, Perry would be found guilty. He would be sentenced to 15 months in prison. He'd be ordered to pay £10,000 fine and also pay £1,200 worth of costs. The judge said that regardless of the facts, if it was his ex-girlfriend's or not, anyone who is on license from prison for a previous murder conviction should be smart enough and be more careful. So, what do you think of this one, Rach?
I think it's mad that he only spent 10 years in jail after being convicted of murder.
Yeah,
I don't think that's a fair sentence for the loss of a life at 18 years of age with your whole future ahead of you. but also taking into consideration this is an older case, you know, we're talking what, 33 years ago today, or round about now, that he committed that crime. Sentencing has changed and is massively different in this day and age, isn't it, for murder. But yeah, I think really interesting, and we don't often go into the appeals into that much detail, do we? But really interesting to understand the nuances of the appeal in this case. And I'm probably just going to admit that I've been really biased towards Perry being convicted, which, you know, usually I try and take a balanced approach, don't I? But I don't know, this case has just got under my skin a bit for the intent I believe he had that he never kind of fully owned up to. And I think that's why it's important that criminals do stay in prison beyond release when they're not willing to own up to the consequences of their actions. But yeah.
I also think, Rach, I agree completely with you. I also think that it raises an important nature versus nurture question, because this is a boy and now a man who was brought up in a reasonably affluent situation. Mm. When he got released from prison for murder, he was immediately made a director of a company, which still, I checked on their company's, company's house or whatever, and they still make $200,000 to $400,000 profit a year. And yeah, he still decided to get a stun gun and a CS gas. Why would you need that? What else is he up to?
Do you know, I didn't even touch on the fact that the family just paid for like the best barrister in the land to defend him in his two, what's it called?
Appeal?
Baby brain's real. Yeah. In his two appeals, he's got like, you know, the best in the land. And that's just, again, you know, throw some money at the problem and let's get over it. This man comes from a well-to-do family and should have, like you've just said, should have really known better and, you know, just suffered the consequence of his actions and not behave like a brat, almost thinking, oh, I'll get away with it if I say I didn't mean to do it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. He didn't then even learn his lesson.
No, exactly. So it's an interesting one. Let us know what you think in the comments on whatever social media you use, what you think about this case. It'd be interesting. Or send us a message if you don't want to be public. It'd be interesting to know what you think. So shall I wrap this one up then, Rachel?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, this has been Season 3, Episode 15, called Midnight Shooting. And if it's safe for you to do so, I'd like you to relax. Close your eyes and picture the scene. How many times do we have to see an appeal fail based on something the person convicted has said in the police interview? Now, is that a good or a bad thing? And the question I have for everyone is, should the ability to answer no comment be brought into question if it helps people have the right verdicts on appeal? Because Perry would have been successful in his appeal if it had just no commented through the interview.
Mad, isn't it?
Yes. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. And a bit longer than normal, but hopefully you've enjoyed this. And next week, I'll give you a sneak preview. The title of the episode is Evil Genius.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun. Yes. Okay, thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.